Well, last week as we began our class, we looked at the importance of a class like this, World Religions and Cults. And hopefully what you understood is one of the primary reasons a class like this matters is because people matter, right? And we think about the gospel for a moment. God sent his son Jesus to save people. And not just people in a particular geographical location, but people from every tribe, tongue, and nation. And as we think about the gospel and we think about the commission, after Jesus raises from the dead and is preparing to ascend to the Father in Matthew 28, he says, go into the world making disciples of how many nations? All nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So this is not a suggestion from Christ. This is a command. And so for some of us, that may mean going on the other side of the world to share the gospel of Jesus Christ. For others, it could simply mean going to the other side of the street, sharing the gospel with a neighbor, the other side of your workplace, sharing the gospel with a fellow employee. But people matter, and the gospel matters. The gospel is the good news of Jesus Christ, that we can be made right with God. And so it's important for us to be able to study a topic like this because there are so many people who are practicing other faiths that we believe are not true. A class like this also matters, we understood, because the exclusivity of Christ matters. What do we say is the exclusivity of Christ? He's the only way. That's exactly right. There's not many paths that lead to the same summit. There is one path, and that path is realized through Christ. As you build relationships with people of other faiths, sometimes it's tempting to say, well, I'm sure they're okay. Right? Sometimes people of other faiths are more enjoyable than some people in our churches, aren't they? You enjoy some of these people. And so it's tempting to just think, well, I'm sure they will be fine. But in all reality, we see that the gospel is very clear. There is only one way to salvation, and that is through Jesus. So people matter. The exclusivity of Christ matters. But third, we understood it's important because eternity matters. We understood there's over 7.3 billion people in this world. 2.3 billion are said to be Christians. Now, of course, we looked at that and understand that's not true, right? That's way more than actually is so, because they include cults that are tied into Christianity. They include Roman Catholicism. But hypothetically speaking, that's still 5 billion people who will one day die, and when they open their eyes, they will find themselves not experiencing the love and grace and mercy of Christ, but instead they will experience his wrath. So it matters because eternity is literally hanging at the balance. Now, I have said in our membership class, and I think it's important for us to understand here, that one of the most unloving things that we can do is not share the gospel. There are many, and I get it, who are nervous, who don't do well in those situations, and there's a sense of fear when it comes to sharing your faith. But refusing to share your faith is like a doctor refusing to give a bad diagnosis simply because he doesn't do well in awkward circumstances. I mean, imagine if you had cancer and the doctor refused to tell you because he didn't want things to get weird, right? We have the key to eternal life. The truth of the gospel is literally at our disposal. We can share it with everyone. So we must be adamant about doing this. Eternity matters. But lastly, we understood that sound doctrine matters. This class is not just to be able to teach you information or just to be able to teach you how to share your faith, but it's also to help you so that you will not embrace false teaching. There are all kinds of faiths, even Mormons especially, Jehovah's Witnesses, who would say, we're Christian. But there's a big difference between what they believe versus what Orthodox Christianity actually teaches. So we do this also to protect you, and so that you can sniff out the teachings that are false. So one of the best ways, ultimately, that we can know sound doctrine is by studying Christianity. And we did that last week. We're not going to go over everything with Christianity 101 again, but everything that we hear, everything that we see, everything that we feel, everything should be measured off of God's Word. The Bible is very clear with what God expects, with who He is, with how we are to respond. And so we must measure everything off of His Word and nothing else. So the way in which we did Christianity is we looked at an understanding of God. We looked at humanity. We looked at the problem with humanity. We looked at the solution, which of course is found in Jesus Christ. And then we looked at how we are to respond to that solution. This is what we're going to do with every faith that we study. We're going to break it down in the same way. We're going to look at origins. We're going to look at the text that they would hold to, because of course Christianity is based off of the Word of God. We believe that God has in a special way revealed himself, and one of those ways was through the written word. So we're going to look at that as well when it comes to other faiths. But as we begin, it's safe to say with just the introductory matters that Hinduism is a religion of over 1 billion people in 51 countries, representing 1,200 people groups. And here's what's so unfortunate. 90% of them have never been reached for the gospel. It's the third most popular religion. And yet there are many who have never heard the gospel of Jesus Christ. When it comes to the countries with the largest amount of Hindus, we see it in Nepal with 81.3% of the population. And then with India, which is 79.8%. Oftentimes you think of India first. And of course, there is obviously a vast amount of Hindus. But what we also know is when it comes to India, there are also many Muslims. In fact, they're saying that Islam is on the rise when it comes to India. There are quite a few Christians as well, or professing Christians. But primarily, India is a Hindu country. Now, although Hinduism is the third most popular religion in the world, it is also considered to be the most complex. One of the first prime ministers of India, a man by the last name of Nehru, says Hinduism is all things to all men. Now, that clears it up, right? It's all things to all men. Bruce Bickle, in his book World Religions, says Hinduism isn't a single religion, but rather a collection of interwoven beliefs that can trace their roots to the Hindu culture in India. So there are a variety of teachings, and of course, depending on who you talk to, you actually may hear or discover something different than what another Hindu may tell you. It's kind of similar when it comes, I would say, possibly even with denominations, right? With Protestant faiths, there's different views, there's different thoughts. So we see the same thing here, but it's even way more complex because there's different understandings of God, like not just like non-essential issues, but like major essential issues. So there are a variety of beliefs. Now let's look at origins for a second. It's important to understand that Hinduism has no specific founder or historical event which marked its beginning. Christianity has a founder. Who is it? Christ. Islam has a founder. Who is it? Muhammad. But Hinduism does not. The term Hindu also was first used by the ancient Persians to refer to the people living near the Indus River in northwest India. So it really even wasn't about religion. It was simply, this is the culture of the people in the Indus Valley. This is what's referred to as the Indus Valley Civilization. This civilization was considered to be just as advanced as the Mayan civilization. They were a very intelligent people living way, way long ago. Around 2500 BC is when really things start moving with these people who are referred to as Hindu. Now, the Indus Valley civilization began, like I said, around 2500 BC. It was eventually invaded by Aryans. These were lighter-skinned people, often referred to as noble ones from the north, around 1500 BC, and it was at this time that the Indus and Aryan religions blended, thus bringing about the first teachings of what we call Hinduism. They were really based upon three primary things. Now, again, this is early, early understanding. First is a belief in reincarnation. And we're going to look at that in detail in a few moments. Second was a worship of a diverse group of gods. Over 330 million gods, and a belief in all things being part of the divine. We are part of the divine. Animals are part of the divine. Rocks are part of the divine. Everything is part of the divine. But whenever it actually was termed as a religious understanding was not until the 19th century. In order to identify those who were not Christian or Muslim, British missionaries in the 19th century developed the term Hinduism to relate to those in the Indian subcontinent who practice innumerable diverse and yet seemingly contradictory religions. So it wasn't until the 19th century that this term was actually in reference to a religion. Some Hindus don't even like to be called Hindu. But then there are others who are just fine with it and they go along. Any questions about that before we go into their text? Now we have a professional here. We have a scholar here when it comes to Hinduism. Pastor Chris has been to India 3 different times. So far, so good? Okay. Yeah. All right. So that's the origins. Now let's look at their text. The earliest Hindu scriptures are known as the Vedas. Is that right? Is that how you say it? Vedas. Okay. They were composed between 1800 BC and 500 BC. Now there is some debate. Some people say 1700, some 15, some 18. I just stuck with 18 and kept it at that, but it was composed between 1800 BC and 500 BC, and they were written in Sanskrit. Now, these understandings, or this basically what was composed, was something that was orally transmitted for thousands of years, or what they would say is thousands of years prior to this, but they were written down around this period. Sanskrit is also the language of the gods. This is what they said that they speak. So the Vedas were originally transmitted orally for thousands of years. They were given to sages. These are deeply religious people in deep meditation by the divine. And so as a result, Hindus believe the Vedas are supernaturally inspired. So just as we understand our Bible to be inspired by God, we looked at that last week, that word inspiration literally is in reference to origin. It has to do with God breathing them into existence through, of course, human authors. Hindus would say a very similar thing. They are inspired by the divine. Now, the Vedas, it ultimately means knowledge. And it contains sacred texts filled with hymns, prayers, chants, instructions for priests, instructions on meditation, and philosophical teachings. And they're broken up into 4 primary parts. The first part is what's known as the Rig Veda, or Veda. It's the oldest work, which contains about 1,000 hymns meant to be sung to the gods of the earth. So the god of the sky, fire, wind, sun, they all have names. There's no sense in giving them all to you. The Rig Veda is one portion. The second is what's known as the Sama Veda. It contains a list of songs, chants, and texts to be sung, which actually recreate, they say, some of the first vibrations of the universe. So when you are a part of yoga or you're meditating in this sound. This is ultimately a sound that goes back to the very beginning when the universe was created. This is one of the ways in which you can actually be in touch or connected to the divine. The Yajurveda is worship formulas and chants meant to be sung in worship service. They're primarily used by priests. And then you have the, I hope this is right, Atharva Veda. Are you familiar with those?
No.
Okay. Yeah. So the Atharva Veda contains magical spells used to ward off evil and danger. They also contain observations on daily life and how to care for one's personal health. Now here's what's important to understand when it comes to these 4 parts. A lot of people don't even really pay attention to the Vedas. So priests will focus on them. They're very hard to interpret to begin with. But a lot of people don't focus on them. What more people really focus on are what's called, and I hope this is right, Upanishads. These are commentaries that expound on the Vedas. They explain questions concerning God, humanity, the purpose of life. Many of them are in story form. So some of the most popular writings are found in these so-called commentaries. Now, any questions or thoughts on this before we move to the core teachings? Yes. Yes. Oh, no. He's Buddhist. Yeah. Yeah.
The chanting part,
yeah, they're very similar. And what we'll discover when we study Buddhism is he was originally Hindu. So yeah, it was an issue over suffering in the caste system, which caused him to change some of the views. Yeah.
Whenever you're referencing the divine, is that one like head god, kind of like Zeus would be for mythology, or is it just all is considered the divine?
We're about to get to that. But in a sense, yes. We're about to get to that in the next part. No, you're good. You're good. Anything else? All right, so let's look at the core teachings. When it comes to the core teachings of Hinduism, it's important to understand that only one ultimate spiritual reality exists. This is known as Brahman. One guru by the name of Jayaram V says Hinduism is unique. Now, this is interesting here. It says Hinduism is unique because it is essentially a monotheistic faith, which acknowledges polytheism as reflective of the diversity in God's creation. God is one, but also many. He manifests himself in innumerable forms and shapes. Now, notice this. Monotheism, yet polytheism. This is where kind of the contradictions begin to come into play, because it's also understood to be pantheistic, which is God is all and all is God. It's mixed with polytheism, a belief in many gods. Is your head hurting yet?
Well, it sounds like it has parallels to the Trinity, though.
Yes, and we're going to see that here in just a second. There's actually three that they focus on. So, yeah. But what they ultimately would say is there's really only an understanding of one supreme God. That supreme God is Brahman. Yet everything in terms of Brahman is connected. So we're connected to Brahman. Everything is connected to this ultimate spiritual reality. So when we talk about things being God is all is God, that there's 330 million different gods, the millions of gods are understood in Hinduism to be manifestations of Brahman. The problem is most of your priests, most of those who are high up in Hinduism would say that Brahman can't be known. Many of them refer to him as not this, not this. So whereas God in Christianity and Judaism would say I am, they would identify Brahman as not this, not this. In other words, he cannot be attributed to any sort of attribute or characteristic. No one truly knows who he is. However, there are these manifestations. I would suggest, in order to really help us understand how the world functions, there's these lesser gods, but they're ultimately a part of this main God. So that's why guys like this guru here would say it's monotheistic, because there is this one primary being. Now, there are three primary gods that function throughout the universe. So here is this kind of, and this is, you can use this as a segue in sharing the gospel. For sure. And we're going to look at some of that here in just a little bit. But the first is what's known as Brahma. This is different than Brahman. Brahma was the creator of all things. He's actually the one who developed the caste system. We're going to look at that here in a few minutes. He determines the organization of the caste system. But he's created all things. And then secondly, there is Vishnu. Vishnu is the preserver of life. Vishnu often comes to the earth through what's called avatars, different life forms. You can use that as a segue in terms of the incarnation of Christ. This would be interesting to them, using that as a conversation piece. So Vishnu comes in an effort to fight against evil and to reestablish religious and moral law. One of the most popular avatars that you've probably heard of is Krishna, right? Some of you have probably heard of it, not necessarily because you've studied it, but because you listened to George Harrison sing My Sweet Lord. If you've heard that song, he's not talking about Jesus. He's talking about Krishna, who is one of the avatars of Vishnu. But then there is Shiva. Shiva is the destroyer of life. So the universe is eventually destroyed, and then the process of creation, preservation, destruction, start over. In other words, time is cyclical. So we would understand time to be linear. There's a beginning, middle, and end. Hindus would say that's not right. There is a cyclical pattern to life. And it's not just for the universe, but it's ultimately for humanity as well. We're going to look at that in just one second. Any questions on the teachings of God before we move to humanity? Now, again, there are so many other gods that we can talk about, but these are the primary ones to focus in on. And again, they're all manifestations of this main spiritual existence. Yes?
Each of these so-called gods have statues? Is that...
Yes. Yep. And what we'll see here in just a little bit is you can actually be devoted to a particular god or a multiple of gods, giving them honor, giving them food, incense, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah. Yep. Any other question?
Do these gods have characteristics? Like, did they attribute things like, you know, emotions like love and... grace and things like that to any of them?
Yes. Brahman is impersonal, so we would not say that he attributes any of those things, but these manifestations come in a variety of forms, and yes, they experience all kinds of emotions. There's gods of war, there's gods of love, there's all kinds of gods. You name it, it's there. Yeah. All right, so when we think of humanity, it's important to understand that each person has a soul called an Atman. The soul is eternal, and it is ultimately connected to Brahman. The body is disposable. What's in touch with the divine is the soul. The soul has no beginning or end. Again, it's eternal. And what we discover is that Atmans are trapped in this endless cycle of living and dying, and living again in a universe that is perpetually beginning, ending, and beginning again. This is known as samsara, or reincarnation. So this is a big problem. This would ultimately be one of the main problems with humanity. They're stuck in this cycle. So it's not necessarily an issue concerning sin, it's an issue concerning this endless cycle. So in reincarnation, an Atman's present life is dictated by what he or she did in their former life. Furthermore, a person's present life will determine how they will live in a future life. This is known as karma. So if you ever hear someone say, oh, I got some good karma or some bad karma, oftentimes in the West we just throw that out there, but it is a term directly from Hinduism. Now, as a result of this, as I said earlier, Hinduism has no really teachings on sin. What a person does or does not do will never affect their standing before the ultimate supreme God. Rather, a person simply gets what they deserve in the next life. It's a teachable moment. It's hopefully something that they will not do again. Problem is, most people don't remember the former lives, right? So the belief in reincarnation is ultimately what resulted in India's caste system. So this was a five-tiered system, which the highest point is Brahman. Now this is M-I-N, not M-A-N. That's made up of priest. That's made up of astrologers. That's made up of physicians. This is the highest of the highest. There is then what's known as the Kshatriyas. These are basically noble people, warriors. So these are policemen, military, politicians, protectors. That's how it's understood. The Vaisyas, if I'm saying that right, I don't know if I'm saying it right or not. These are people basically who are producers, merchants, farmers, craftsmen. Shudras are the laborers. And then you have the untouchables. These are the people of the lowest caste. This is what caused much problems, especially as India sought to be an established nation. These people, especially the people in the higher caste, they would never even talk, look, help any of the untouchables. It wasn't until Gandhi ultimately referred to them as children of God, that things began to shift, which, as Chris even alluded to earlier, the caste system has actually now been outlawed, but this was a primary function in Hinduism. The reason why people found themselves in a particular caste is because of what they did in their former life. So you can't help them. They get what they deserve. This is true, full-fledged justice, right? I mean, you think about Christianity. God had every right to give us what we deserve. What we deserve is punishment. What we deserve is hell. The difference is God decides to give us what we don't deserve, which is grace and mercy. There's no grace and mercy with Hinduism. So here's the thing, though. When it comes to one's caste, it's determined by birth, so it should not be changed. It cannot. If a person lifts one person out of a particular caste into another, that person would receive bad karma. Because this was dictated by Brahma. This is not dictated by humanity. All right, so let's look at salvation. Because there is salvation according to Hinduism. Salvation is found basically in being relieved of reincarnation. Reincarnation is a never-ending cycle that can only be broken through moksha, which is liberation from reincarnation. So you break the cycle. That's salvation. That's what you're longing for. So, well, what happens when you break the cycle? You become one with Brahman. You basically kind of cease to exist. You're just a part of the divine. So that's the goal with Hinduism. Now, there are three primary ways to achieve moksha. The first is what's known as dharma, which is the way of works. Now, you don't have to do all three. You can pick one. So you treat people fairly. You be kind to one another. You work hard. Just be a good Hindu. So for them, doing it this way, they would ultimately say, well, the problem with humanity is a moral problem. If we just are good people, then we can eventually be liberated from reincarnation. Again, this is a very simple understanding of dharma, but it's the way of works. Secondly, there's, I think, jnana, which is the way of knowledge. So for them, the primary problem is ignorance. Why? Because the only true reality is Brahman. Everything else is an illusion. So basically, a man is required to forsake all things. They should just devote themselves to meditation, reciting sacred sounds, and practice yoga. There are many cases where they left their family, where people left everything, their jobs, their families, simply to devote themselves to the way of knowledge. So the goal is, if I practice enough yoga, if I recite enough sacred sounds, I can become one with Brahman. This is the ultimate understanding of what yoga is. It's spiritual. So it's not just a bunch of ladies getting together on their time off and stretching. Like, that's what Westerners have sought to do, but there is a spiritual understanding to yoga. And this is the understanding. Empty the mind, constantly fixate upon that which is Brahman, and try to become connected to it. Now, the problem is when you say, well, we can meditate, right? We can empty our minds. No, the Bible never tells us to empty our minds. The Bible tells us to fill it with the Word of God. So yoga, I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing, but there is spiritual understandings to yoga. And we have to be very careful when there's all kinds of debate. Should they do it? Should they not? I'm not saying that you should or not. I'll leave that up to Chris. I can't even sit Indian style. So I can't do stretches. So there's the way of knowledge. But the third, and this is the most popular way, is what's called bhakti. This is the way of devotion. So it's love and devotion toward gods or a god throughout one's life. This is why you see these statues with incense and flowers around the statues and food being offered to them. They're devoting themselves to God. Again, one of the primary examples is Krishna. They devote themselves entirely to him. If you devote yourself to him, you will hopefully experience moksha. So the primary problem to them is a spiritual problem. Just be more spiritual. Just focus and love specific gods, and you will eventually be liberated from reincarnation. But here's the thing. When it comes to this, you never know where you stand, right? There's just this constant working and trying to be able to achieve liberation, but you never know when it's going to be. You don't even really know what God thinks of you doing this, right? What if you're doing it wrong? Who knows? So that's kind of the core teachings of Hinduism in a nutshell. Well, let's go ahead and dive into sharing the gospel with Hindus. I think one of the things that's most important, especially for us when we find ourselves interacting with people, I've had a couple, when I was up in Louisville, when I worked for Verizon, we would kind of play a game with the seminary guys of like, hey, let's see how many people, as we're selling phones, how many people we can share the gospel with. And we had a couple of Hindus that came in and we talked. One of the things I think is very important is that we must be slow to speak and quick to listen. As Christians, it's easy to disregard views that we don't hold, right? Things that are completely foreign to us. But we must be gracious. We must be respectful towards those that we disagree with. Of course, we believe that it's completely wrong. And we chuckle at some of the things and the inconsistencies. But this is how people were raised. So we're called to be gracious to them. James 1:19 is very clear on this. We also understand it from Proverbs 18, verse 2, which really all of our country should pay attention to this. Fools find no pleasure in understanding, but delight in airing their own opinions. Good grief, if that isn't Facebook and Twitter, I don't know what else is. But this is also in terms of faith. We listen, we ask questions. And as Peter emphasizes in 1 Peter 3:15, we're always ready to make a defense of the hope that is within us, but with gentleness and respect. So we are slow to speak, quick to listen, ask many questions, listen to what they say. But one of the things I would say is that you've got to talk about the bad news of the gospel. It's interesting to me, Gandhi once said, "It is an unbroken torture to me that I am still so far from him," speaking of Brahma, "who, as I fully know, governs every breath of my life and whose offspring I am." There's this torture here of, I just can't do enough. I'm a broken person, I'm a flawed person, and for us, ultimately, we would point them to a passage like Romans 3:23 and say, absolutely, you're right, all of us have sinned. And all of us have fallen short of the glory of God. This is one of the things that we were emphasizing when I was in Louisville with one particular Hindu couple. It's just this emphasis of you can't do enough because you are always falling short of God's glory. We can help them see that we're guilty of turning to other gods. This is what God actually accuses us of. We see it with passages like Genesis 35, Isaiah 45, where he's calling on people to put away their gods and to follow the one true God. The problem is, as Romans 1 says, we have refused to worship the Creator and instead have worshiped creation. We've exchanged the truth about God for a lie. And as we open the Bible, which they would encourage you to open the Bible and read it with them, because we've done this, what does Romans 6:23 say? The wages of sin is what? Death. So we must then ultimately talk about the good news of the gospel. We must stress to them. And I really, one of the things we did is we really tied it into the creation narrative. And I think there's a variety of ways to do this. But we stress the importance of understanding that all people are made in the image of God. They're not gods, but they're made in his image, which means they're equal in terms of worth. They're equal in terms of value. And being made in his image, we're able to communicate with God. In other words, then what we ultimately say is that God is personal. You say he can't be known, but my God can be known. The only God can be known. Jeremiah 9 is very clear. Let not the wise man boast in his wisdom, the rich man boast in his riches, or the mighty man boast in his might, but let he who boasts boast in this, that he understands and knows me. And he goes into detail as to who he is. So we say we're made in his image. We are a people who are able to communicate with him. And even though we mess things up, we stress to them that God has promised to send one who has sought to make things right. It's destroyed ultimately evil. We do this by then ultimately pointing to Jesus. This is the main part I would suggest. How many conversations you say did you have where you're just pointing them to Jesus?
They're really open to listen.
Yeah.
Because they're a very spiritual culture. And so talking about, you know, in America, we're about, oh, you don't talk about religion or politics. You know, but in India, it's so much a part of their culture that they're really open. It's nothing shameful to talk about religion with them. In fact, that if you just one of the just asking them about theirs and then they're open, you can conversation just be open and then to turn it.
Yeah.
About Christ, and it's just, they're very, very open to listen.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things I found, and I keep going back to Gandhi because he's one of the most popular that we would know of, but Gandhi says, I shall say to the Hindus that your lives will be incomplete unless you reverently study the teachings of Jesus. Right? I mean, you think of even the Gospels, you think of what Jesus taught, here's the things that you do. Now, of course, as we talk about the bad news, we ultimately realize we can't live up to what Jesus does. But God says, listen, you should listen to the teachings of Jesus. So we then begin to ask questions. Explain to me your idea of God becoming human. Oh, well, let me tell you about Vishnu becoming human through, for instance, Krishna. You say, well, that sounds very similar to the God that I worship, yet there are some distinctions here. But you point them ultimately to the incarnation of Christ. Let me tell you about what my God did. My God stepped down from heaven and into the earth as well. You open your Bibles to passages like Matthew 1, 21 through 23, which talks about Jesus coming to the earth through a virgin and saving people from their sins. You read to them a passage that says she will give birth to a son and you are to give him the name Jesus because he will save his people from their sins. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord has said through the prophet. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. This gets the wheels turning, right? From this, we then begin to ask other questions. Have any of your gurus ever died and come back to life? My Christ died and came back to life. See, point them to the death and resurrection of Christ. Explain the significance of Jesus overcoming death, of defeating evil and overcoming Satan. Through this, you eventually talk about the significance of the death of Christ and how through faith in the sacrifice and resurrection of Jesus, we can now receive not what we deserve, which is punishment, but instead what we don't deserve, which is grace and mercy. This is a big deal because that you get what you deserve. It is what it is. You reap what you sow. But with Christianity, you get what you don't deserve, right? We're dead in our sin. We are pursuing the passions of our flesh. Ephesians 2 verse 4. But God, being rich in mercy, and it's alive in Christ. So we emphasize grace. We stress to them the truth that because Jesus died, the death reserved for us, there is then no other way for people to be saved. That's a big one because they're totally fine with recognizing Jesus. Okay, he can be a God. Sure, that sounds great. We'll put him alongside all the other gods that we have. No. There's a big distinction here.
That is true. We had that happen.
Really?
One of the girls in our group was sharing it with a teenage girl. And she's like, yeah, I want this Jesus. I will put him with my other gods.
Yeah.
That's exactly what she said, and that's what she believed.
Yeah. So, I mean, you think about this. Okay, if he's simply one among many paths, why in the world would he die this violent, brutal death? Right? Why would he rise from the dead? All of this is done in vain if he's not the only way to salvation. You can even use as a segue, speaking of the fact that, yes, we are spiritual beings, but God has promised to one day return. He's promised to return to the earth where we will one day receive a new and perfect body and a new heaven and a new earth. Things won't be destroyed. We won't simply cease to exist and become one with Brahman. We will dwell forever with God. Jesus is the biggest focal point that you would point to. Because, again, there are certain illusions. Now, there are many other things. The Trinity, like when we talk about Brahma.
I don't see how you can avoid a prompt discussion about the Trinity and addressing this, because that's where, you know, the understanding that they have to worship one God is critical, and that's going to immediately, you know, bring up the conflict in an uneducated person's mind about the Trinity.
Yeah, and I think one of the best things that you can do as well is, as you're using this as a segue, you say, well, yeah, I get that they're manifestations of this one main God, but our God is one, realized in three persons. The Father has willed for this salvation to be accomplished. The Son has brought it to fruition, and the Spirit has ensured that we can experience salvation. They all play this significant point, but they are one. Now, that will be a fun conversation to have, but again, you use it as a segue to be able to say, here's the similarities, but here's the distinctions. It's not just three separate gods that are manifesting one. No. It's three persons in one God. Have fun with that. Take systematic theology. We go over to the Trinity. One of the other things I think is important is we must pray both for and with Hindu people. Offer to pray with them. The ones that we talked with, I remember working at Verizon, we prayed with them. They never said no. Pray with them. Stress to them that God, as our Father, hears our prayers and promises to answer our requests. Now, that doesn't mean they get what they want. They get massive tips. But because I have this relationship with Christ, my Father listens and my Father will respond. There is an assurance here. So you can read to him passages like John 16. That day you will no longer ask me anything. Very truly I tell you, my Father will give you whatever you ask in my name. Until now, you have not asked for anything in my name. Ask and you will receive, and your joy will be complete. God is personal. God is actively involved with us and he responds to our prayers. But then ask how you can pray for them and then pray out loud with them. This is one of the biggest things that we can do, even praying for their salvation, putting your hand on them, praying that God would save these people and come to a realization of truth. And there are other ways that we can share the gospel, but again, I think the biggest one is Christ. It's focusing on the incarnation of Christ. Were there any other methods that you guys used when you were there? Anything else that you pointed to when you were witnessing?
That have like symbols on them that takes you through the gospel, and they'll actually walk through the gospel with the people and explaining each symbol on it. And it's all, okay, all points back to Christ and what it does. So.
Gotcha. All right. Well, is there any questions before we're done? Yes.
So the reincarnation, they want out of reincarnation?
Yes.
So is it like a punishment?
Well, it could be. Sure. Again, if you do something in your present life, it will affect your future, whether good or bad. But it's basically just this dreadful, never-ending cycle that just continues on. So their desire is we got to be freed from this cycle. We've got to just become one with Brahman, and that's where we will have rest.
So then how come the guy that Jeremy was talking about didn't realize that maybe something he did in his past life is now affecting him?
I think that's what he was trying to figure out. What was it?
He was searching, and like he's just totally confused. He's like, and that's what the guy that I was working with, he went back and said, "Look, man, if you can't locate what you did wrong, then this religion that you believe in is false."
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
How does that work with like the animals? Because don't they think they would come back as animals, like even insects?
Yeah, you can come back as all kinds of stuff.
How does that work with them, like in the?
So that's the reason why most of them are actually vegetarians. Is because of the fact that they could be eating. Yeah.
Like in within that caste system, is that like, is there? She just doesn't.
Well, so if you come back as a mosquito, that's pretty bad.
It's kind of an untouchable, right? Yeah.
Well, the good thing is that reincarnation is very short.
Yeah. But now, what's interesting? So there's a myth that Hindus worship cows. They don't. Cows are just very sacred. Cows were understood to be producers of life, so they provided milk, cheese, butter. They provided dung, which provided fertilization. So they just regarded them as sacred animals, but they never worshipped the cow. Yes, yeah. Well, yeah. So the primary are the commentaries, and there's a whole variety of different ones that you can read. Man, it was, you know what's funny is I was going online trying to find like direct quotes from the Vedas. I couldn't hardly find any. It was all the Upanishads, the commentaries.
I've never had a single Hindu actually reference any of their sacred texts.
Wow.
Coming back as a cow or anything else,
yeah.
Other than them believing they produce milk or whatever the case may be,
to
provide for the top god, there ain't no hope there. And if you ain't got no hope, you can't breed no faith.
Yeah, and one of my questions is, if reincarnation is a learning process and you're supposed to do better, why are things getting worse? Why are there more wars? Why is 2/3 of your country in extreme poverty? Like, it's not getting better. It seems like there's a flaw here in the system. And the flaw is ultimately we recognize is sin. Sin is the primary issue.
Well, that would be their answer in reincarnation too. Karma is progressively getting worse because you're going to continue to sin. You're going to continue to be reincarnated and have to suffer the consequences of your sin, which is going to lessen your situation each reincarnation. Yeah. It seems like it would be impossible to over time become a better reincarnation because...
Yeah.
You're always going to have some fault, some sin in each.
What I have read is that some said that they were so in touch with the divine, certain ones were, that they could actually begin to understand what happened in former lives. That's the same with Buddhism as well. Buddhism teaches that.
Well, and a way too that they try to appease this, because their concept of sin is millions upon millions go into the Ganges River every year for the washing away of their sins.
Mm.
Yeah.
The reason I ask my question, I have a lot of students here, Indian, and their parents, and what I've got from a lot of them, they don't seem like they're the problem. And they're sending their kids to Christian schools because it's private.
Right.
They don't really think about it being a religion. I mean, it's like, it's a religion. They honestly...
Oh, yeah, it wouldn't be a problem.
The exact same as Christianity.
When you don't
see sin. They don't see sin. I mean, I have one girl who's come to know Jesus, but she can't. She says, I have to go to my bathroom to pray. My parents can't know that I'm praying to Jesus. She's like, she's already has an arranged marriage, and that she's going to have to go through. She's going to either, because their house is in India, she's going to have to go back to India and this whole exchange thing. That, and she knows that's just her life, and it's like, she knows, but she's trapped where she's lost every bit of her family. And their family is so important to them that that's like, and especially when you're, like why I asked about the Patel, because they're very wealthy people. And so they don't see that it's bad because their life, in their terms, is good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she will face persecution whenever she goes back.
Yeah, isn't there a fairly large group of Hindus that are actually violent? That, I mean, it's on the highest.
Yeah, I would say it goes across the lot, because we had seen some believers who had come to faith, and they faced severe persecution from their families. And Hindus are known, especially more in northern India, to persecute Muslims and persecute as well Sikhs. And because of, and a lot of times too, there's a merging of their religion and their nationalism for India as well. Because one of the interesting things was, we were talking to a group of late high school, early college guys, and it was kind of interesting because part of them were Muslim and the other part were Hindu, and I'm like, what's up? You know, y'all hang around each other, you know, and they're like, because we're Indians first. And our religion is everything else. So there's this deep sense of nationalism that's kind of merged into there as well. And so they face persecution.
And would you say the main persecution is because they would suggest that it's the only way? That Islam is
they just don't
pure?
Like, I think
just don't like them? I got gotcha. You.
Just persecution.
Yeah.
It seems like it's very hard to determine where their cultural system and their religious system...
It all merges together.
Yeah.
Most of it.
Well, India's flag has a wheel in the middle of it, which ultimately represents the cycle that keeps happening. So, I mean, their own. I mean, it's kind of like, I guess, our quarters that would say "In God We Trust," or, you know, they would. So that's a very important part. Their religion is a part of their not only culture but even their entire government.
So to wrap it up, how is our church doing over there? Don't we sponsor a church, a pastor?
So Julie is over there, and her whole team of missionaries that are on the ground there. Last I would need to get, I know there were about 10 to 15 people over there at any given time, Americans living in Mumbai. We've been able to see the Gathering Church come up off the ground, and they're meeting virtually because they've been on shutdown. I'm not sure kind of latest update in the past month or two. And then also, we helped out and been a part of the church that Julie went to, which if you remember several years ago, Pastor Crispus Christian, who came and spoke here. And so, you know, one of the cool things is that God has opened the door for Mercy Hill to be right there in India, especially Mumbai, because Mumbai is a city, a pretty small land-wise, but it's 25, 26 million people live right there. And where it really is, like a percent of those, like 0.02% could be evangelical Christian.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's a hard place. You know, you go in there, and it is a very, very hard place to go because the people really have not been receptive of the gospel, you know that it's really just up that you just pray for the Spirit of God to move whenever you're sharing the gospel with people, and somehow that seed would take root. Because most of the people that you talk to and come encounter with, they've never even heard the true gospel. They are familiar with Catholicism, but they've never heard the true gospel.
And we were supposed to be there during Diwali this year. But unfortunately, COVID changed that. All right, anything else before we close? All right, so next week we'll be off because that's the day before Thanksgiving. But after that, the next week we'll meet again and we will look at Buddhism. Buddhism is very similar to Hinduism. And like I said, the Buddha was formerly a Hindu. So we'll dive into that religion. After that, we'll look at Islam and we'll just keep right on going. So if you don't have any other questions, if you do and you didn't want to ask anything, feel free to email me. Love to be able to just write back to you and be able to help you with anything you might have. But who's going to close this in prayer?